From the Sky News Centre at 6, some breaking news, and a 22-year-old man has been charged with the murder of missing teenager Georgia Williams. In the last few minutes, police have confirmed they discovered new evidence yesterday afternoon and that the 17-year-old had died in an address in Wellington. Superintendent Nav Malik is leading the investigation.
A body of a young female, has been found in woodlands in the past near Nantyre Garth in Wrexham, North Wales. At this moment in time, we haven't identified that body, but early indications do suggest it's linked to the disappearance of Georgia Williams.
One of the men suspected of the Woolwich murder, Michael Adebolajo, has been discharged from hospital and taken to police custody. He'd been recovering after he was shot by police. The doors on both engines of a BA plane involved in an emergency landing last week had been left unlatched during maintenance. That's according to an interim accident report, with the Transport Secretary Patrick McLaughlin saying the aviation industry must learn lessons. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
What do you like?
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Watford Council refuse a permit for the Bilderberg Fringe Festival. Why have they opted for a confrontation with the NATO elite? And the Bristol meeting of the People's Assembly Against Austerity took place on Wednesday evening with local guest speakers, as well as comedian Mark Steele and independent columnist Owen Jones. And Steve Timmins from Protect Our NHS is in to explain what a People's Assembly is. Plus, the drones, flown by remote control or by a computer, they're killing increasing numbers of innocent people. One joint US university study estimated recently that 50 innocent civilians are dying for every single terrorist suspect that's killed by a drone strike. Well, Barack Obama made joke about killing his critics in the US with drones, but one side in all this is very happy. The companies that make the drones are Lockheed Martin, that makes the Hellfire missiles. So, should Lockheed Martin's shareholders and directors be prosecuted for aiding and abetting war crimes? Talking of which, it's been a big week in Syria, with big decisions being made about bringing in missiles to take out aircraft and also possibly MiG jets to defend Syrian airspace. But we start kind of where we left off with the cuts, really. Prime Minister David Cameron, the leader of the Human Shields, I call him, Nick Clegg, and Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne want their pound of cuts, and the fire service is going to be no exception, it seems. Does that mean if you call 999, a fire engine might turn up too late? Well, to discuss this, I'm joined by Phil Jordan, who's the Regional Secretary of the Fire Brigades Union. Hi, Phil. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
First of all, can the fire service actually make savings? Surely there's a little bit of fat in there that can be cut out without actually affecting the service itself.
Yeah, I think that's the very important point. There are areas where the fire service could make savings. What is not acceptable to the members of the Fire Brigade Union is when those savings will put lives at risk. And once you start attacking the frontline service, the response service to incidents, then lives will be put at risk. And to me and the members of the Fire Brigade Union, and I would suggest to the public, that is going to be an unacceptable position to be put in.
What about the cuts then? How much, what's happening in the way of cuts regionally? I mean, you're covering a whole region. The Fire Brigade Union, how many people are in the union nationally?
Well, roughly, we've got around 40,000 members of the Fire Brigade Union. And I cover all the way from Cornwall up to Gloucester. And our membership is about 95% solid FBU members, whole-time firefighters. We cover a lot of the firefighters who are now under threat for cuts. The major cuts that are being talked about in the southwest, Devon and Somerset are facing the loss of 140 frontline whole-time posts. Bristol is facing 84, or Avon is. These are all going to have an effect on the type of response that we can give, or the fire service can give, to emergencies. And we have always said that the response to an incident is absolutely vital. What can be a small fire can very quickly develop into a huge fire, and our job is to stop that happening. These sort of cuts that have been proposed, which will make fire engines take longer to attend incidents, will cause death and property fires getting out of control.
But Phil, isn't it true to say that by its very nature in the fire service, a lot of the time firemen are sitting around twiddling their thumbs, and that somehow, surely, there must be a way of taking that out of the system where there's less time spent, you know, sort of sitting around waiting for the phone to ring?
Firefighters don't sit around just waiting for the calls to come in. That's an old idea of what the fire service is about. You'll start be talking about snooker tables and that sort of stuff in a minute. That's not the case anymore. Firefighters do a lot of preventative work, going out to houses and businesses talking about reduction, because the fire service has switched from a very more into preventative mode than responsive mode. But however, people are still dying in fires, fires still happen, and the public still deserve and expect a fire engine with a fully trained crew to turn up and save their life should they need us.
Well, that sounds dodgy in itself. What's a fire crew doing? Round in a school or something, doing some preventive? I mean, surely, then they're not available to be out on call.
At the moment, the situation is that the crews that do these talks are available. There's always one member of the crew stays on the fire engine, and should the control room contact them, then the crew come rushing out, like they would rush to the fire engine on the fire station, and away they go. That response to emergencies must be maintained.
So will these proposals that you just mentioned, will they put lives at risk?
In our view, yes, because what I've just mentioned, the initial stages of a fire are absolutely vital if we are going to be able to save lives. It's well known that most people who die in a house fire die through smoke inhalation, so it's the smoke that actually kills them. So we need to get there with enough crew to break in, pull people out and rescue them. There's a very sad case in Blaenau some years ago where two firefighters were killed because they turned up to a fire with only one crew of five, and they were faced with making a choice between attacking the fire that was going in the kitchen or searching upstairs for two kids that were reported in there. On the second entry to make another rescue, this fire exploded into a flashover and actually killed the two firefighters. Basically, that happened because there was not enough crew to dampen then the fire to make it a safe situation for firefighters to enter into. And that is going to happen more and more now, whether a crew has to do a rescue or put the fire out. And I can tell you now, professional firefighters, their first choice is always going to be rescue lives. And with only a small crew there, that is going to put both the public and firefighters at risk.
But what about the proposals for merging? I mean, won't that improve the frontline response to emergencies?
Well, we've actually got a case of that in the region, in the southwest region now. Devon and Somerset merged a couple of years ago, and already they're having to make further cuts to frontline services. So this idea that a merger will actually protect the frontline services is absolute rubbish.
Okay, what about the, I mean, because apparently some of these retained firefighters, these are the guys that are out, and women, of course, who are out in the sticks, not in the big city centre fire stations, this kind of thing. They seem to be, some of them anyway, seem to be behind this, because the idea is to make more of the fire service less of a full-time service and more of a retained service. I mean, isn't that actually a fairly sensible way of trying to reduce the cost of this?
Well, one thing it will do is reduce the costs. Whether it will improve the service or maintain the service is very doubtful. Retained firefighters do make up a large portion of the fire service, and because of cost, that is a necessity. But the situation with the report from that the government have had an advisor produce for them is calling for on-call firefighters to be used more and more. The fact of the matter is, an on-call firefighter takes 5 minutes to get from their place of work or their home into a fire station before they've even jumped on the fire engine. And this is where we constantly talk about the response time is absolutely vital. More use of retained firefighters will make the response time even longer, and that, as I've just said, that sort of thing will put lives at risk.
But I mean, surely this, in a way, the fire service is a victim of its own success, because you know, you've done such a lot of work over the last 5-10 years to actually reduce the number of calls. What we hear is that they're getting less calls, and that there are less fires to put out. Surely it doesn't make sense to maintain the same level of service.
Well, that all depends if you're the poor person who happens to have a house fire and you're stuck upstairs waiting to be rescued. And it is an insurance policy, if you like, to have a first-class fire service available to rescue as many people as we possibly can. And that's what we need to maintain.
Okay. As what about, does the Fire Brigades Union take a position on the cuts generally, and as part of the political movement? Do you pay money, for example, to the Labour Party to lobby for you in Parliament?
No, we made a decision in 2004, I think it was, to disaffiliate from the Labour Party. We don't affiliate to any political party anymore. We do a lot of campaigning, and we talk to all the political parties. In fact, we talk to anybody we can, who is making the decisions that we need to influence. All the cuts now in Bristol and in Devon and Somerset, there's an ongoing campaign by the Fire Brigade Union to talk to politicians to put our view forward, because they're listening to advisors. For instance, look what us taxpayers had to waste thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds on the regional control room, which the so-called expert advisors, chief fire officers and the likes of Sir Ken Knight actually told the government this is a great idea. And at the moment, there's an empty building just off the M5 in Taunton, still costing the taxpayer thousands. The Fire Brigade Union, the professional voice of firefighters on the ground, said right from the day it started, this was a nonsense, and we've been proved right. So it does call into question whether or not these advisors are actually doing it for the service, for the public, or whether they are just political puppets.
But if you want a bit of influence to make sure things like that don't happen, surely you have to affiliate to a political party.
I don't necessarily agree with that. There's a big debate in the Fire Brigades Union on whether we should reaffiliate. It was just confirmed 2 weeks ago at our conference that we wouldn't. We've got an FBU parliamentary group that we still have, a group of sympathetic MPs who do listen to us, and we have had many a question asked on the floor of the Commons. So we've got an influence through that way. It's just we don't, our members don't want us to fund any one particular party at this moment in time.
Phil, are you actually employed by the Fire Brigades Union now?
No, I'm a firefighter from Gloucestershire.
Oh, okay. And can you just tell us a little bit about your experience as a firefighter? What experience, you know, how long have you been doing it and whereabouts?
I'm only 3 years from the escape. I got 3 years till I retire. I've been a firefighter since I left the Royal Navy back in 1986. Done all my time based in different stations in Gloucestershire. And from an early stage, I decided that I wasn't happy with firefighters being treated poorly, both through disciplines and just general conditions of service attacks, that I chose to take on a union role. And it sort of escalated from there, and I've progressed right up to regional secretary, where I am now.
Give us an idea of the sort of nuts and bolts of what the Fire Brigades Union does, as someone that's been, you know, sort of, should we say, ordinary firefighter, and also taking a role in the union. What are the sorts of issues that you're dealing with day to day that make you feel that what you're doing is worthwhile?
Well, internally, obviously, there's a lot of things to do. The fire service since 2003 has seen a real escalation in discipline cases. It's unbelievable, the sort of stuff that goes on in different fire services now, which requires union officials to represent the members. We're being kept very busy with disciplines.
Well, without using names, give us an example of the sort of thing that you think is a sort of trivial disciplinary matter that you have to be there for your members on.
Okay, we are getting people disciplined now for issues which I'll go into in a minute, give some examples where what is required is the old style telling off. I was going to use a different word there, but that's where it should be dealt with, at low level. Person told that that's not acceptable, don't do it again. Now that is going to discipline. Things like a firefighter recently was walking from his fire station to, I'm going to give it probably where it is now, to a open air swimming pool, wearing a t-shirt, fire service t-shirt, the towel. Now that person has now been given a note for 5 or 6 months to improve his conduct.
Sorry, what t-shirt?
A fire service t-shirt. It's his work t-shirt. Now that, okay, if they didn't like the fact that he was walking 50 yards from the fire station to the pool right opposite, he was actually given a telling off, and it should have stopped there. But that ended up with a formal note for file. And it's little things like that, trivial things that would normally just need the boss to give you a telling off, straighten yourself up, and it's just getting out of hand. But there are a lot more serious ones that I won't go into because it'll be obvious.
What I was asking you about was the sort of more trivial type of thing, and that is quite frustrating, isn't it?
It is.
I suppose the other question is this whole business of the, you know, you mentioned this place down in Taunton, which was set up as a regional control centre. I mean, it did seem a little bit strange from the outset to have one control centre where obviously it helps if you're dialing 999 to be speaking to somebody who is reasonably local. What's the state of play there? Because if some of these proposed mergers go ahead, are we again facing the fact that we could be picking up the phone, dialing 999 and not even speaking to someone in Bristol, maybe speaking to someone in Gloucester or Taunton?
Yeah, that is always going to be a possibility. You're going to get the advisors who got a bit of a bloody nose, if you like, and being told they were wrong, bringing it back onto the agenda. The Devon and Somerset merger has resulted in the Somerset control room, which was in Hestercombe House, now merging into the control centre in Exeter. That is always likely to happen. The issue about a regional control room, there is actually a need for that sort of facility. If there was a major incident in the region, it makes sense to be able to have a control somewhere controlling the whole incident. And we've said that all along, but that can be done with interfaces from where they are. There is no need to shift every control room with its local accountability, democratically controlled by the authority in that area, to one central place. It just isn't, just doesn't make sense, because the local knowledge and the ability to respond to local incidents are a lot better working with police and what they call GO Command, and the ambulance service is a far better model. And in fact, the situation in Gloucestershire, where they've got a control room where the police, the ambulance and the fire are all in the same building, is an excellent model of working together. And it just shows that a regional control room just for the fire service would be an absolute nonsense.
Okay, Phil, finally, can you just give us an idea of you know, how people can follow what the FBI are up to? I imagine you've got a website or something, and explain a little bit about how you're organised across the region.
Okay, we're split into, every fire service has got its section of the Fire Brigade Union. So in this region that I cover, there are six brigades, and we've got an FBU branch in each one. Each fire station workplace has an FBU branch. We communicate through the branch meetings. We have got a Southwest website, and we're on Twitter, and we use YouTube. We're moving very much into the electronic media sort of arena. One of the reasons for that, actually, is so we can get our message across without being edited and twisted and spun by the government if we're ever going to go into some sort of huge dispute. So we have people in it, reps on each station. Health and safety reps are trained to a different level, and we do everything we can to make sure that the members that pay into the Fire Brigade Union get the best possible representation, be it discipline, grievances, conditions of service, attacks on our shift systems, all that sort of stuff is all covered by us. We're the only representative body that sits on the National Joint Council for the Fire Service, and we are proud to be the professional voice of UK firefighters.
And do you think the 999 service, if we need it, is safe for the next couple of years?
No, I don't, unfortunately. With the way that this government is forcing through their austerity cuts, with this ideological attack on the public services, I think we are in grave danger. I think the cuts that are being threatened and proposed around the South West, we are going to have to fight very hard to prevent them happening. And we do need the public to look at what they want for their fire service and take an interest in protecting their fire service. Otherwise, if these cuts go ahead, we'll never get them back.
Well, Phil Jordan, Regional Secretary for the Fire Brigades Union, and your 40,000 national members, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And Martin Summers, we're going to do our little tour of the world's hotspots. We're going to start, though, Martin, with the obvious one, I suppose, and that is the European Union this week deciding that they are going to lift the arms embargo on selling arms to, or even giving arms to, the Syrian rebels. Let's start on that first point. I mean, the Syrian rebels actually buying these arms, or are they donated?
Well, they're being bought for them, perhaps by the Qataris or the Saudis, but in actual fact the European Union as a whole was not at all happy. It was the British and the French who were pushing for the lifting of the arms embargo on Syria, all of which is a bit by the by, because in actual fact, through various cutouts, the British, the French and the US have been supplying the rebels from the very beginning.
OK, well, let's listen to William Hague and the announcement after a very, very long meeting that he'd got his way with the EU.
The European Union has agreed to bring to an end the arms embargo on the Syrian opposition and to maintain other sanctions on Syria, all the other existing sanctions on the Syrian regime. This is the outcome that the United Kingdom wanted. It has been difficult for many nations, of course. That is why we've had such long discussions today over the last 12 or 13 hours or so. But I think it is the right decision, and I think the whole of the European Union is very strongly committed to a political settlement in Syria. So yes, there are, of course, on such a difficult foreign policy issue, there are disagreements. And yes, we've had some disagreements today, but we have resolved those disagreements, I think, on the right basis for the future.
Disagreements resolved, says William Hague Martin. So it sounds like you're wrong.
Well, there was an Israeli general who was interviewed, and he said, well, we're really unhappy with the EU deciding to lift this arms embargo, because that's provoked the Russians to say that they're going to supply these anti-aircraft missiles to the Syrians. The whole thing is escalating, and William Hague is blundering around in a China shop, frankly.
Well, it's not just these S-300 missiles, which, by the way, were first introduced back in the 1970s. Mm. I mean, it's not. I keep hearing the BBC saying that they are the most advanced weapon system. Actually, no, there's a thing called the S-400.
Well, got Iskander missiles as well, which knock out aircraft carriers, and they're even more interesting.
But in the anti-aircraft world, they're also talking now about selling these MiG fighter jets to the Syrians. It all seems to be a bit hotting up.
What's happening is the Russians are sending a clear signal that we're not going to back down. There's supposedly a peace conference in Geneva coming up, but because the EU, under British and French pressure, has agreed to lift the arms embargo, the rebel groups won't be attending, probably, in Geneva, although Assad's people will. In other words, the last best hope to settle it is being thrown away.
Now, the spokesperson for the European Union is this High Representative Catherine Ashton. She's a curious figure because she's never been elected to her job. I believe she's in the House of Lords, which, of course, she wasn't elected to either. Mm. She was just appointed to that by a previous Prime Minister. And she used to be the treasurer of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament many years ago. But now here she is making these announcements and big decisions about whether the EU is going to do this or whether the EU is going to do that in its foreign policy. She's actually essentially the EU's foreign secretary or, secretary of state or whatever for the EU. Who is Catherine Ashton?
Well, I mean, you've just given a brief potted history of who she is. I mean, that's all about as much as I know about.
What legitimacy does she have?
Well, she's speaking on behalf of the EU, but the EU can't make up its mind what it wants to do, so most of the time it's actually a pretty useless pitch to be bowling on.
OK, well, let's see how she gets on, because this is her announcement on Sunday evening.
Reality is you weren't in the meeting and I was. And so I can tell you that this was a really important debate and discussion. And I've said this at the European Council, I've said it publicly many times. All positions on this are really honourable because everybody is trying to work out how best to support the people of Syria and how best to ensure that we get to a political solution as quickly as possible. And what I saw around the table, and the reason it went on for so long, was a strong desire for the European Union to come together. You're quite right to point to the fact that member states may take different decisions. That doesn't mean that we've lost the capacity to have a common policy.
Well, if members are making different decisions, it doesn't sound quite like a common policy, but is that just a bit of spin?
Yes, I mean, it's her job to paper over the cracks, because various other countries in Europe were adamantly opposed to lifting the arms embargo on the Syrian rebels. They've seen the videos of the meeting people's hearts and all the rest of it. They don't trust that they are the good guys. The British and the French are still playing their 19th century games, as far as people in, I don't know, Denmark might be concerned, you know.
Yesterday morning they also discovered chemical weapons in Turkey. I mean, this is pretty horrific. Very interesting. What's the background to that?
What's very interesting is that, do you remember there was a bomb attack, three car bombs in a village just over the border inside Turkey, which the Turkish government then blamed on the Syrian armed forces. They denied it. They've now arrested several Sunni jihadists from Al-Nusra Front in Syria for that bombing. And when
who is the Al-Nusra Front?
They are the Al-Qaeda linked rebels inside Syria who are doing most of the fighting against the government, and they've been backed by the Qataris and the Saudis and the British and the Turks, the British and the French behind all of that. So it turns out that our allies that we're trying to arm are the ones who bombed the place in Syria in order to create in Turkey, if what's coming out is true. And then when they arrested them, they found that they had a kilo of sarin. Goodness knows where they got that from. Presumably they were going to use it and try and blame it on the Syrian government. I would suggest that there are no good guys in Syria. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and frankly, there were no good guys there
either. But what's the significance of this group in Turkey? It just sounds as if just across the border there's something rather nasty going on, if they've got nerve gas.
What's been happening is they've been funneling weaponry and fighters over the border into Syria, and you've now got a sort of Islamic International Brigade fighting the Assad regime in Syria, supported by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, indirectly supported by the Israelis, the British and the French. But isn't it interesting that Al-Qaeda and Israel are on the same side against the Syrian government? What goes around comes around.
Well, one person who's not at all happy with this, he said it actually last week before the decision was made, is Conservative former Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd, speaking in the House of Commons last week.
Rather looks, announcement by announcement and step by step, that the government is moving perilously close to agreeing with some form of intervention in this matter. As a result of any intervention, the people concerned in Syria, the mass of the population, would be better off. And unless they can be assured of that fact, that they would be better off as a result of intervention, it's much better to leave it alone.
Better to leave it alone, says Douglas Hurd.
Yes, well, I mean, he's a wiser head than some others that are running the show at the moment.
What about Syria's President Assad is saying, I'm now targeting my rockets onto Israel, and he's suggesting that there may be some kind of competition and conflict over the Golan Heights. Where are they, and what's the historical significance there?
Well, they were seized from... the Israelis seized them from Syria in 1973, during the 1973 war, and Assad didn't respond, for example, to the Israeli airstrike on Damascus that killed quite a lot of his people the other week. But he's beginning to win the war internally now, with support from Hezbollah, the Iranians and the Russians, and he hasn't crumbled away like Gaddafi. And of course, what happened to Gaddafi, where he's just kind of killed out of hand on YouTube, that Assad saw that and said, well, there's no point talking to you people, that's what you want to do to me. You were quite happy to cheer when that happened to Gaddafi. That's a very clear message to us not to give in, and we're not going to.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, the Bristol's meeting of the People's Assembly Against Austerity took place on Wednesday evening with local guest speakers, as well as the comedian Mark Steele and independent columnist Owen Jones. Steve Timmins from local Protect Our NHS is in to explain what a People's Assembly is and what they're planning next. Well, first of all, hi, Steve, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much indeed.
What is the People's Assembly? Give us a little report of what happened on Wednesday.
Well, what happened on Wednesday was a meeting in the Malcolm X Centre in St Paul's, and it was a great occasion. I mean, I don't know how many political rallies you've attended, but when was the last one that was fun? Because this one was terrific fun. The People's Assembly Against Austerity, it's trying to bring together all the many different local and national campaigns against all these huge cuts and the privatisation of our public services, and then they're going to try and develop a strategy, they say, for resistance, which they hope will mobilise millions of people. And they're going around the country to different cities, and Bristol was on the list. And there's going to be a huge rally in London on the 22nd of June at Westminster Hall. And the information all about that is on our Twitter feed. Anyway, the hall in Bristol was absolutely packed. No standing room, and we heard from a raft of the local and national speakers, as you said. And locally, it was Paulette North was there from Bristol Barrack, which is backed activists rising against the cuts. There was Joanne Kay from Unison, and Laura Welty from the Bristol Disability Equality Forum. And from the national campaign, we had the Vicky Bars from the National Union of Students. And I have to say, it's very nice to see them active again on more than just their own problems and funding and tuition fees. And the kind of key figure was Owen Jones, and he's the guy who wrote that book Chavs, the demonization of the working class. And he looks about 13 and a half, and he's got a terrific terrific knowledge of the subject, and he's very passionate. And his was this a rallying cry he delivered to us, so to stop shouting at the TV screen and get out there and actually do something. But as you said, the star turn was Mark Steele, and I'd like to say he was a Crystal Palace supporter. I don't suppose Bristol City want to hear this, and so am I, a Crystal Palace supporter.
How on earth do you manage to bring humour to something which is actually pretty devastating, with disabled people losing benefits, some people committing suicide, this kind of thing? You know, some of the most vulnerable in society being hit the worst. It sounds almost impossible to make have a laugh in that kind of context.
Well, that was made very clear, especially by Laura Welty, who was saying how appalling it is, and how Paulette North was saying how the loss of financing for black communities was 20% higher than anything else. But, I mean, for instance, he came out with some very obvious points about the deficit. I said, OK, we have a huge deficit, and you're the government, what do you do? So the first answer is you blame the previous government endlessly, and then you think, okay, then we need to have some money to get rid of the deficit. So the answer to that is obvious. You take it from the poor, because they're the ones who have the money, not the rich. They've scarcely got enough to get by on. You hit the poor and you keep on hitting them. And he was doing a lot of stuff like this. And it was a very non-party meeting. There was more mick taken out of Ed Miliband than there was out of anything else. I think Mark Steele defined it was a very nice chap, but someone you'd only want to meet and have a little natter about for 5 minutes until you realise what he did. So, but he might make a good estate agent. Not sure about that. anyway, his point was, I mean, to go back to Crystal Palace, Mark Steele again, was that if Crystal Palace can go up into the Premiership, we can actually fight the cuts and do something proper about it. That's a very important thing. So we were all there as Protect Our NHS, and we were cheering along and handing out leaflets at the end for people to sign and give to their GPs to say none of us want our health services privatised.
So you obviously got a bit of a buzz out of it, I can tell.
Oh, it's terrific fun.
But actually any action and any real change coming out of it?
Yes.
This is the trouble, isn't it? It may be fun, it may be a bit of comedy, but the worst thing, the thing you don't want is for it to just end up being a talking shop.
No, I think that would be disastrous. And that was what's great. It's not politics. It is actually about we've got to stop what's going on. And the number of people who came up to us afterwards and were saying, we want to do something, we will take your leaflets, we will give it to our GP. And the number of people who were surrounding Owen Jones, and the number of people who were signing up to go to the meeting on the 22nd in London. And that's a meeting which, I mean, Tony Benn is speaking at. But it's going to be a meeting, I think, which will energise people. That's what I came out with, and I still am. Absolutely.
But is it about energy, or is it about organisation?
I don't think at the moment it's about organisation. One of the funny things about it was the number of people who got up from local campaigns, and they kept on to these Freudian slips, like saying, we will work with our enemies, I mean our friends, you know. And there is still a huge amount of division, and sooner or later, yes, you're right, they're going to have to pull that together.
Martin, isn't really the left generally a victim of its own, I suppose, infighting to a large extent? A lot of these left groups see themselves as the great sort of flag wavers and standard bearers for the poor, and actually they're all kind of in competition. A little bit like the whole Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you know, the People's Republic of Judea and all this, the Front of Judea and this kind of thing. Isn't that actually a real serious problem in the left, whereas much of the right seems to be quite, you know, either maybe possibly you know, UKIP may be an exception, but most of the right seems to be on the same page.
Well, I think the right's problem is that right wingers hate each other, you know. so fascists, Muslim fascists hate Christian fascists, and vice versa, and so on. But in actual fact, the left in principle ought to be able to be united. And if we're serious, that's how we've got to be, and that means accepting that people have got different views and different ways of approaching things. Of course, there are some people in the Labour Party, for example, some people who are not, but we've got to have a united front to try and change this drastically bad policy.
Yeah. What about your role in Protect Our NHS? Because obviously that is a serious, but you are serious about it. There's no question about that. You know, what are you doing at the moment to try and get your message out, and actually to change this concept of you know, turning the NHS into, basically, we're open for business. Any big international pharmaceutical company or healthcare company can come in and take a bit of the cake.
I think that we're at the point still of just giving people information. And I think what Martin was saying was, Mark Steele said that You talk about parties in the centre. And in fact, but if you look at it, the centre has shifted well to the right. I think that's something that people forget. And we're trying to point out some of these ridiculous things that are going on. Like from October, the South West Ambulance Service will be run by National Car Parks. Like the Oasis Dental Care has been brought by the private equity company which owns Pret a Manger. I mean, it's all these ridiculous things that are happening. And at the meeting that was a week before to herald the tendering process for mental health services in Bristol, there were private health companies there owned by the venture capital company Grove Group, which owned Winterbourne Down. So we're just trying to make people realise this is happening. And if it doesn't, you know, you've got to stop it. Go out, tell your GP. That's what we're asking people to do. Talk to your GP. They hate it. Only 11% of GPs support this. And it's, so that's where we're trying to go anyway.
Isn't Western General Hospital also up for grabs, I think? I mean, it seems to be one of the problems, almost endemic here, is that the many of these NHS bodies that run it, the foundation trusts largely nowadays, are having to cope with some of them. I mean, particularly the North Bristol Trust right now is going to be very soon having to cope with this massive PFI debt. And so eventually they're going to be going, well, can someone please take us over?
Well,
maybe the banks, simply the banks that are taking them over.
Yes, I think the original, I don't think it's even ideological on the part of the Conservative Party. I think it is just purely, it's big money trying to get in there. Excuse me. And they will cherry pick. So they're not going to take out A&E and services like that. And this is Western General's problem. It's too small, a hospital. So I was just reading a piece which I've just put on our blog, which was saying that, and this is an academic study, which funnily enough, even the Daily Mail reported, which said that for every additional 10 kilometres from an A&E which closes to go to another one, your chances of dying increase by 1%. So people in Western Supermare, you'd have to travel, you know, 30 kilometres or whatever it is, 3% extra chance of dying just because they've moved your A&E.
Pretty shocking. Martin, what can be done about this ultimately from a macroeconomic point of view? What we're being told is that we simply have to do this because it's an EU directive, and also that the government wants to do it. I mean, they've got the reins of power, and they can. They also happen to be very, very close to the international, largely US healthcare firms.
Well, none of it appears in the Conservative manifesto, and in fact lots of Conservative grassroots people who we've had on here don't agree with it either. And when you say the centre has shifted, I don't think the British people's centre has shifted. What's shifted is the debate amongst the elite about what can and can't be done. So if we had a Labour government, no doubt these silly ideas would still be being pushed, and that's the problem. And that's why people are beginning to realise that it's not just about the NHS, it's about whether we've got a democracy at all.
Yes. Isn't it true to say that the previous Labour government under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair actually set up the whole process by which the NHS is now being hived off and that is being opened up to competitive tendering?
I'm a member of the Labour Party and I would agree with that. But the fact is that the Labour Party is still a large organisation. We did pretty well locally in the local elections here because Labour people are pragmatic. They're trying to, we're the biggest potential stone in the way of this, of all of this, and we are potentially an alternative government. Now we've got to actually seize that and carry it through, but we can't do it on our own. The Labour movement on its own, the Labour Party, isn't big enough. We need to build alliances beyond that. But at the same time, of course, we've actually got to stand up for what we claimed in the past to stand for. And of course, what's actually happened is during the new Labour era, we lost a lot of lost our way, in my view. But a lot of people have stayed loyal because they know that that's what always happens. The leadership of the Labour Party have always been vacillating and hopeless. Hence, in the red flag, you know. Although cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Steve, finally, your organisation, Protect Our NHS, is actually based in Bristol. You meet in Bristol. Can you tell us, whereabouts to find you? Do you actually meet face to face? Are you one of these sort of just a Twitterati types?
How dare you? No, we meet the first and third weeks of each month on a Tuesday evening at 7:30 in the Robin Hood pub on St Michael's Hill. We get a good group turning up there.
Robin Hood being a very good place to meet.
Yes, very nice pub. Except we've got a problem on disabled access because we meet upstairs. So, but for the time being, that's where we are. But we've also got our own Twitter feed on @NHS Hour and our own blog, Protect Our NHS. www.wordpress.com.
Okay, that sounds like pretty comprehensive ways to stay in touch. For you at the moment as a group, what is your main priority in the city, other than just this whole idea of raising awareness? Where do you think are going to be the pinch points in the next few, you know, sort of months and weeks even?
I think it's more months than weeks, and what's interesting is how long it takes to commission stuff. The key things that are happening in Bristol is the recommissioning of mental health services and the closure of certain levels of child and adolescent mental health services. And with trying to fight that, every CCG meeting, clinical commissioning group meeting, we ask questions and we insist on answers. The answers back from Bristol are very good, comprehensive. We don't agree with them, nor Somerset. We're just patronised. So we have to keep on pushing at that and pushing at that, and then get the GPs on our side.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it, that you're getting a completely different reaction in North Somerset than you are here in Bristol. Why, do you think?
Well, as I said last time, that the lay chair of the clinical commissioning group in North Somerset is also a consultant to Capita Simmons, the private health company.
Well, how on earth can...
She leaves the room. Don't worry. There's no conflict of interest. She leaves the room when an issue comes up. It's that...
Gracious alive. So that is really does seem to me like a quite amazing conflict of interest, Martin. How can someone do that sort of job whilst they're, you know, basically wearing two hats in the same room?
Well, we were talking about bankers earlier and the head of HMRC turning up to get a job in with the Deloitte. That's just a revolving door, isn't it?
Mm.
And that's a big issue.
I think someone down in North Somerset needs to sort themselves out. Anyway, Steve Timmins, thanks very much for Protect Our NHS, and thanks very much for your report on the People's Assembly.
Thank you very much.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it's drones flown by remote control or by computer. They're killing increasing numbers of innocent people. A recent US joint university study estimated 50 innocent civilians in Pakistan are dying for every terrorist suspect that's killed by a drone strike. Barack Obama, though, likes to make jokes about drones in front of the US press, as he did here back in 2010.
The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans. But boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming. You think I'm joking?
Well... Not a joke as far as I'm concerned, but anyway, Predator drones, you'll never see it coming, Martin. Sounds a little bit like the Nazi V2s in the Second World War, used as the vengeance weapons on London, because they flew, they were the world's first ever ballistic missiles, and they flew faster than the speed of sound, so nobody ever saw them coming either.
No, but I mean, I suppose what those who support the drones policy would say that it's not just a random attack. It's a very targeted attack. Although, as you say, studies show that for every so-called terrorist that they claim to have killed, and who knows what that means, 50 civilians die.
Well, this is first of all, it's a terrorist suspect that they're going for,
quite.
Not somebody who's proven to be a terrorist. And secondly, it's actually a real top US universities actually did a survey right across Pakistan of all the drone strikes, and they found that only one in 50 of the people killed were even a terrorist suspect.
Well, that's right, and of course all the main political forces in Pakistan right across the spectrum have been saying to and it is a democratic country, it's a bit wobbly, have been saying to the Americans, will you please stop doing this? In other words, it's totally illegal. So as somebody sits in Nevada driving their drone over the border into Pakistan to kill somebody, they are in fact breaking the law, and ultimately they will probably have to go to prison, or according to existing US law, they might even have to be executed.
Well, I was down in Frome on Wednesday evening, where I met one of the speakers at a Stop the War meeting, Chris Cole from Drone Wars UK.
My name is Chris Cole from Drone Wars UK, and I'm here in Frome tonight to speak about the kind of growing use of armed drones.
Now, for many people, they're seeing the whole idea of Guantanamo Bay and secret prisons, as we've just heard this week in Afghanistan too, as a bit passé and embarrassing. Much easier, of course, to eliminate people from the air, to kill people with a drone. And so how is this industry expanding? Clearly, you know, some people in the Western world particularly see this as the way forward.
Yes, unfortunately that's true. I mean, over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a massive increase in the use of armed drones. From 2004 to 2007, there were something like 9 drone strikes in the world. Jump forward a couple of years to 2010, there were like 130 drone strikes in Pakistan alone. And now, just recently, we've had figures that show there have been more than 1,500 British and American drone strikes in Afghanistan. And of course, the drones that we have at the moment are fairly crude and slow, the kind of Tiger Moth biplane generation, really, of the drone wars. And that's very quickly changing now. We're moving from these slow, although they're armed, they're fairly slow and cumbersome drones. We're moving very quickly now into much more autonomous drones, drones that are stealthy, drones that can fly supersonic jets. And the main difference is that they're not controlled by pilots on the ground. They take off, fly pre-programmed missions, and then come back and land all by themselves. And within the next 5 or 10 years, we will certainly see autonomous drones undertaking attacks around the world. And that's a big worry.
So who's actually building and who is using these drones to kill people?
Yeah. Well, there are 3 countries that are known to have used armed drones. That's the US, the UK, and Israel. And there are a whole number of different companies involved. The main country that's been involved in exporting drones around the world is Israel, but the United States is catching up quickly, and there's enormous pressure on the United States now to allow the export of these armed drones around the world. And that's coming from not only countries like Germany and France and Italy and many, many other countries around the world who want to have this armed drone technology, but also the companies themselves are putting huge pressure on Congress to allow the export of drones. And so it's estimated now there's about 70 countries around the world that have some form of unmanned drone technology in their military arsenal. Many of that will be fairly crude and small. But again, unfortunately, very soon we're going to see a huge proliferation of drones around the world.
How do they fit into international law? Surely it is actually illegal to fly a drone over another country, a sovereign nation, and use it to kill people in a double way, really. First of all, you're violating somebody else's airspace, and then secondly, you're murdering somebody.
Yes, well, unfortunately, there is a huge argument about the legal issues. The United States claims that it has the authority that it granted itself under the authorization of use of military force in the days immediately after 9/11, and it granted itself the power, and they say that they're at war with the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and what they call associated forces. And that is like the torture issue, where people say, oh, we'll just use it on a few occasions. It's expanding and expanding, and now, as you say, the whole world has become a battlefield.
Well, you say associated forces there, Chris. That could be almost anything. What is an associated force?
Well, that's the big problem, that there are very few definitions of what these things is, and there's huge pressure in the United States for the US to clarify, to be more transparent about what it sees as associated forces, and to explain what their legal reasoning is. But unfortunately, despite this week President Obama coming out and giving a big speech about the counterterrorism and the use of drones, the kind of questions associated with the use of drones outside what are officially declared wars, if you like, are still very, very unclear, and we need much more clarity. But it's not just the unclarity around the US use of drones. Israel too has used drones, we believe, in Egypt and Sudan, and the UK is using drones in Afghanistan. UK pilots have also flown American drones in Libya and Iraq. So we need much more transparency, we need much more information about the use of this technology.
Is it possible to prosecute somebody who flies or programs one of these drones that then subsequently kills somebody?
There are attempts to undertake legal action. In here in the UK, Reprieve has undertaken a legal action against William Hague and the UK government for supplying what it calls locational intelligence to the US for drone strikes in Pakistan. That's fallen at the stage, but the Reprieve are appealing the judge's ruling. Basically, the judge said that this was too secret to go into in a court of law, and Reprieve are appealing that. So certainly, yes, there will be more and more legal cases around the use of drones.
Also, we heard recently there's a German drone program that's been secretly chugging along behind the scenes.
Well, there are a huge number of drone programs of all sorts. I mean, I think what you mean is the armed drone program. There is a drone called Neuron that has been developed by, it isn't so much the countries, but the companies that are involved that I think is the issue. And because a lot of these companies are multinational. And so, as you say, the Neuron drone, which is an armed drone program, is being built by EADS and a number of other countries. Here in the UK, BAE Systems are involved in building an armed drone called Taranis and Mantis. Italy has just hinted at that they were involved in what they call a black or secret armed drone program. So behind the scenes, there are lots of drones being built. The drone, of course, that caught the headlines towards the end of last year was the Sentinel drone, which was either brought down or crashed in Iran, and that was what was called a black program for many, many years, and there is still very, very little detail about that drone in the public sphere.
So this is something which is built by the West, but Western governments deny it exists, and yet the Iranian government or hackers in Iran apparently hacked into the thing and took over control of it. Can you just go back to the German drones and understand that the money that was being used for that is now being diverted somewhere else?
That was the Eurohawk, which is being built by an American company, actually. It's based on a drone called the Global Hawk, which is in all sorts of trouble because it doesn't work. And one of the whole issues about the secrecy that surrounds these military programs, of course, is that, you know, there's a great deal of scepticism about how well these things work. But yes, the Eurohawk was just cancelled recently, but one of the outcomes of that was that the German government said that there would be another $500 million to spend on other drones, and they're very keen to buy American Reaper drones and Predator drones. So that's where German money is heading into the coffers of the United States.
So it's a bit worrying to think that we in our taxes, you know, whether that be income tax, VAT or whatever, are actually paying for these things. How has that been allowed to happen?
Well, the UK has already spent more than £2 billion on drone technology in various ways, through directly purchasing drones, through developing drones, through research in universities, etc., etc. And there is actually another program being developed at the moment by the Ministry of Defence called Scavenger, and the Ministry of Defence have estimated that they want to spend £2 billion on that. But all these things, as you say, are being done behind closed doors, and the amount of secrecy that surrounds the drone program is of great concern, and we must try to break that secrecy.
The other thing, of course, is that many people are actually investing in arms companies now because they're worried about maybe other firms suffering with the recession. The arms industry seems to be doing rather well.
There will always be, as we know, money for wars. Huge parts of our economy are being cut, hospitals, schools, all sorts of things, welfare, but there always seems to be money available for new weapon systems and for wars. You know, this is a huge part of the problem, is that people aren't aware of these systems. People are kind of cosseted watching, you know, Britain's Got Talent, or kind of concerned about the new royal baby. And I think that's what the government wants us to be concerned about, these kind of irrelevant things. And we have to kind of try and break that and wake people up. And that's partly what we're doing here tonight, raising awareness about these issues and educating people about the real issues.
I know you've got quite a good online site, Chris. Where can we find that?
Thank you very much. It's www.dronewars.net.
Chris Cole there, speaking to me on Wednesday evening. Martin, the ultimate problem here, though, is that there are companies and shareholders and directors making a fantastic amount of money out of building drones and building Hellfire missiles.
Indeed, and of course the policy is being driven by arms manufacturers, not by soldiers. Soldiers, are, you know, who actually have to risk their lives, tend to be a bit more sceptical about the effectiveness of the technology that they're asked to use. Those who are selling it are just selling it.
But one of the things we've been hearing this week is that the Israeli Defence Chief, sorry, that's not the wrong, got the wrong story there. Crikey, where are we? Mossad, CIA and Blackwater are operating in Syria, according to the Russians, anyway. A security operation in Homs has revealed that Mossad, CIA and Blackwater are involved in the military violence in this part of Syria, as over 700 Arab and Western gunmen and Israeli, American and European-made weapons have been detained in the Barba Arma district. Syrian security forces got yet further proof of Western
powers' military involvement in Syria's internal conflict, reports Al Manar, a news agency affiliated with Hezbollah, a Lebanon-based militant group and political party. Also seems, Martin, that Hezbollah started to work very closely with Syria. I think, historically, aren't they two... It used to be the same country, didn't they, Lebanon and Syria?
Well, yes, it was part of French Syria, and then Lebanon was split off from it. I mean, this is when the British and the French were under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, drawing lines on the map. What's really worrying about this now, with the conflict spreading out from Syria into Lebanon, into Iraq, is that the whole of the situation in the Middle East is going to turn into a major war. And this is what the fire that people are playing with.
So if they're correct, what they're saying here, the Lebanese, and that Mossad, CIA and Blackwater are operating in Syria, who's paying for this?
British and American taxpayers and Israeli taxpayers.
Well, how does that work? I mean, you know, surely we can't, the MOD surely just can't pay for Blackwater or someone like that.
No, they can. They have huge budgets which are not accountable. But in any case, if you've got any problems, you can always start dealing drugs, which is what these organisations have done for years. So there's one theory about what happened at Lockerbie, that it was in fact a CIA drugs run which was infiltrated by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, who put a bomb on the plane pretending it was the CIA's heroin shipment to New York for that week, and that's how they got it on. Now, I'm not saying that's true, I'm just saying that's one of the theories about what happened at Lockerbie. And of course, the fact that the CIA and all these other organizations are involved in drug dealing is hardly a secret.
Another international story. Russia has warned Obama global war over bee apocalypse is coming soon. Apparently, the Russians had demanded that the lack of or the problem with the bee population was going to have to be on their summit. Kerry was kept waiting for 3 hours by Vladimir Putin because the Americans refused to discuss the bees.
Well, I think what is the source of this story, Tony?
This is EU Times, and the shocking minutes relating to the President Putin's meeting this month.
I mean, it's a relative...
Some minutes have come out, apparently.
Yeah.
An extreme outrage from the Russians.
Well, also, you've got a colonel in China saying that the SARS outbreak in southern China is biological warfare by the Americans. It's not by a general, it's just by a colonel who's saying that. But I think we are, in fact, on the cusp of World War III. Everybody is getting so upset with each other that we really are going to start major killing.
Well, the road to Damascus, I mean, this is a biblical thing, isn't it? Mm. But it seems like Damascus could be a key point. Finally, then, the NATO zone mafia dons, the Bilderberg elite, are coming to Britain next week, from Thursday through to Sunday. We will be going down, we'll certainly be covering it next week, because the conference will be right in the middle of going. But the thing that really worried me about this, Martin, was the first 20 years this conference was chaired by a former SS officer and a former member of the Nazi Party, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands.
Well, it's all about linking the US and the Western elite and the Western European elites, and so that's what that was about. And don't forget that Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head up the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, became the head of the West German intelligence services, and quite a lot of ex-Nazis were simply integrated into the Western intelligence structure in the 1940s. And there's a book by Francesco Imposimato. I can't remember the name exactly. Yeah. He's the honorary head of the Italian Supreme Court. It's been published in Italian last December, and basically it's accusing the Bilderberg group of being behind all the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s.
Well, one of the other fascinating allegations against the Bilderbergers is that they're a kind of representative of this Fourth Reich Bormann network, a financial network that uses, instead of tank divisions, panzer divisions to smash and take over territory, it uses corporations and money.
Well, there's a book by Paul Manning called Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which is worth looking at, and from the internet. But of course, the linkages between the Nazis and the Western intelligence services are documented.
Cyrus the Virus is up next. This show is at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, the newly elected Labour councillor for St George East, Steve Pearce. I'm Tony Gosling. We'll see you next week.